Trail Mix is a geographical show about art and the journey as a form of process and product. Today we'll be joining three artists and three mythic West Country landscapes as we set out from Kessel Barton, a gallery on the Lizard in Cornwall, into the wilds of West Penwith.
Creating something that not only is a record, but but also somehow captures time passing. The idea of a ledger line is slightly different. That's a very specific term that comes from music. Ledger lines are the lines that rise above and below standard notation to kind of carry the extra notes, so to speak. So there's another idea that is about kind of extra layers of information coming in. Landscape that is about building up information and creating an idea about a place or the experience of being in a place through layers and layers of information. Now, Michelle Stewart is an American artist. She's 84. When we think about the ledger and this idea of building up a kind of record, in Michelle's work, what we're talking about is two different ways of capturing a landscape. And the first and most obvious is through a photograph. And what you can see in these works is that she has taken black and white photographs of various locations in the landscape. But she's then paired them with what she calls drawings. But these are actually, they're not drawings in the conventional sense of, you know, taking a pencil and trying to kind of make an outline of an object, you see. These are drawings that are made by rubbing the earth from a particular place into the paper.
In a single photograph, the horizon is a line from one side of the frame to the other. Do we really see our surroundings in this way? No. Because we look around, we don't look at. In this way, the horizon is a circle, and we are always at the centre of the circle.
This particular body of work is quite unusual in that it's made here in England, and specifically around the ancient sites of the Ridgeway, Silbury Hill, Stonehenge, and the Avebury Stone Circles. The paper is actually kind of impregnated with the material of that place. So these works basically give us two different ways of understanding a landscape. They give us a way of what it looks like, i.e. a photograph, and then this kind of tactile sense of what it actually is.
Roads are the most enduring works of man. Partly, of course, they are works of nature, because man, with all other animals, seeks the easiest path to get where he wants to go. And the best route over or round hills, across rivers, or through jungles is determined by the structure of the land. Sheep paths on a hillside follow the ledges of natural contours. The track to a waterhole runs where no rocks or great trees stand in the way. Once trodden by human feet, a natural path becomes a work of man, each traveller marking the way for the next.
If you listen, you can hear it call. Sometimes it's peaceful, and sometimes it's wild and free. Love is a traveler on the river of no return. Swept on forever to be lost in the stormy sea. Willery, I can hear the river call. No return, no return, no return, no return. Willery, I can hear my lover call. Come to me. No return, no return. I lost my love on the river, and forever my heart will yearn. Gone, gone forever.
In Sophie Rickett's work, there's a completely different approach happening. And these works come from a project called To the River, which is a large kind of multi-part project that comprises two main elements. There's a film, a three-screen film, and then there's this kind of archive. And the project as a whole is about the Seven Bore, which is this extraordinary tidal wave that rises up the River Severn, and it's so large that on certain occasions you can actually surf up the river on the bore. So it's all about the kind of anticipation and the social kind of connections that people form while they're in this particular place. But what we're looking at here in the gallery are cuttings that she's taken from various books about the Seven Bore, some of which are about the scientific phenomenon, you know, how waves are formed, how bore waves are formed. Some of which are more about the kind of landscape and the history of the Seven Bore. All kind of creates this way of thinking about this particular place in the landscape and an event that happens in this particular place in the landscape that is layered. Our experience of the landscape being something that's very, very multifaceted, very complex, that is not simple, but is a kind of ledger. We all carry a kind of ledger within ourselves about the landscape that we pass through. And maybe that's the moment to hand over to Abigail.
Which means the stone with the hole, which is above Morvan.
Menantol, near Morvan, Cornwall. SW427349. There are other holed stones in Cornwall, but this one, also called the Crick Stone, is the best known. Many of these stones are supposed to be helpful in curing certain illnesses, and children were once passed through Menantol when they were suffering from rickets. Stones with holes big enough to crawl through and with similar beliefs attached to them can be found all over the world. There may once have been some benefit to be gained from such customs, for if, as is proposed elsewhere in this book, certain stones can hold powerful currents passing through the earth, could not the hole serve as a focus for this power, which would pass into the body of and give renewed vitality to anyone climbing through the hole?
I live in St Just in Penwith, and my studio is in St Ives. So to travel from home to the studio, I take the Zenner Road, which is a road where you're constantly caught between the sea and the high moor. And Morvan, you go through Morvan, and Menantol's just above. And then I come over to St Ives, and then you see Gadrevi Lighthouse in front of you. And for me, the conversation I'm having with the landscape is very rooted also in other women who have been part of this landscape and who thought about it. And those women are Virginia Woolf, whose novel To the Lighthouse is ostensibly set in Scotland, but it's actually her childhood experience of spending the summer holidays in Carbis Bay, looking down constantly on Gadrevi. And Daphne du Maurier, who wrote many stories very specifically to here, because Frenchman's Creek is right here, and she also wrote an amazing, very weird novel about time travel, where this character takes a drug and he keeps moving back in time to the sort of late Iron Age, and then something really awful happens to him at the end. It's great.
The house on the Strand. The first thing I noticed was the clarity of the air, and then the sharp green colour of the land. There was no softness anywhere. The distant hills did not blend into the sky, but stood out like rocks, so close that I could almost touch them, their proximity giving me the shock of surprise and wonder which a child feels looking for the first time through a telescope. Nearer to me, too, each object had the same hard quality, the very grass turning to single blades, springing from a younger, harsher soil than the soil I knew. I had expected, if I expected anything, a transformation of another kind, a tranquil sense of well-being, the blurred intoxication of a dream with everything about me all misty, ill-defined. Not this tremendous impact, a reality more vivid than anything hitherto experienced, sleeping or awake. Now every impression was heightened, every part of me singularly aware. Eyesight, hearing, sense of smell, all had been in some way sharpened, all but the sense of touch. I could not feel the ground beneath my feet. Magnus had warned me of this. He had told me. You won't be aware of your body coming into contact with inanimate objects. You will walk, stand, sit, brush against them, but will feel nothing. Don't worry. The very fact that you can move without sensation is half the wonder.
So she wrote this book called Vanishing Cornwall, where she travels around Cornwall in a car with her son, and he takes photographs, and she writes this extraordinary Daphne du Maurier-esque, kind of slightly purple, recounting the history of the landscape. If the stone had a hole in it, the wisest thing to do is to crawl through it 9 times against the sun, which is an interesting use of the word wise. And for me, Toll behind us is a large, it's instead of folding the paper, it's like folding space. So this, the space of the gallery is kind of, or these stories attaching to these stones, my journey has been folded.
Cornwall remains the tale of England, still aloof and rather splendidly detached, crouching amongst the sand dunes and the tufted grass. A sluggish indolence pervades. His myth is everywhere. He hunted upon these moors, the last outpost of an aged Cornish king. It is a moment of satisfaction and tranquility to spend itself at dawn in a sullen calm. Our only companions, gulls and ravens.
Daphne du Maurier, Virginia Woolf, Barbara Hepworth, and they are probably the reason why I'm here, actually. This is a print by Barbara Hepworth. It was made in 1970, it's called Etea. And when I saw it, which was at the Hepworth in Wakefield, it's part of a suite called the Aegean Suite, I realised that because of the way she's drawn it, it would freestand if you fold it. So if I'll leave this here, but if I just take this piece of paper and I fold it into the lines that I did fold it in, it will freestand, and it's the same. It's basically, this is a sort of pop-out of because I realised that she's drawn it in a certain slight perspective, which means that if you fold along the bases, it will freestand. So the structure is a simple translation, because Barbara Hepworth made sculpture. It's a translation of a print that she made in 1917 into a sculpture. If you were an artist, you could make your own world, and you could live in it. Yeah,
you step through a kind of magic door into another universe.
The exact course of the road I knew. But already the old sense of orientation had gone. There was nothing to serve as guide except the ground itself, the valley and the hills. The waters of the narrow channel rippled swift and blue over the sand, leaving on either side a frothy scum. Bubbles formed, expanded and vanished, and all the ordinary timeless waste came drifting with the tide. Tresses of dark seaweed, feathers, twigs, the aftermath of some autumnal gale. I knew in my own time it was high summer, however dull and overcast the day, but all about me now was the clearer light of approaching winter. Surely an early afternoon, when the bright sun already flaming in the west would turn the sky dark crimson before the night clouds came.
What's the order in which those kind of connections happen? Did you experience the journey and think, I need to kind of find a way of connecting these different places and ideas? Or did you see the Barbara Hepworth and think, I could populate that structure with images?
I think in my work, but different experiences shine different lights. So it's as if your studio practice or the things that preoccupy you is like a three-dimensional object. And when you shine different lights, you see different facets. And my current facet is the idea of the journey, because that just happens to be where I am now. You're also very, very aware of the Bronze Age if you live here, just because you just stumble upon it all of the time. And wanting to sort of convey something of my experience of being in this landscape. But I do love, I think all of my work really starts in books. And that, and I knew about, I've read To the Lighthouse before I came to St Ives. And it's, Virginia Woolf is such a very strong taste. She's, you know, you don't forget her. I don't know if any of you have read Daphne du Maurier's book, but she captions in the most surreal ways. But it's ostensibly, it's a travel guide. You know, it's landscape writing. It's, you know, like Ian Sinclair and Robert McFarlane, and it's within that genre, it's now a genre of a kind of nature writing, actually. And she's trying to unpeel the different historical layers of Cornwall from this book, but she does it in this.
So let's talk about journeys, because you said that's something that's very important for you right now, and I think that's another kind of interesting connection here, because you know Michelle's work is very much about walking through a landscape. You know, sometimes she uses the photographs in the works to almost stage a kind of narrative, you know, mile one, mile two, mile three. On other occasions, she's kind of making panoramas or something like that. But to me, these convey quite strongly the sense of being on foot in a landscape. You know, surface work is about all these people who've come to one place. I was struck by what you were saying about the you know, journey on your motorbike, and I was just wondering if there's something being on a bike or on foot kind of allowing you to be exposed to the landscape in a way that you can't be if you're enclosed in a car.
Well, you're more vulnerable, aren't you? More aware of the precise texture of the terrain or the camber of the road, and you know, on a motorbike it's less than on a pushbike, because you're really aware of the hills on a pushbike, and that feels even wilder and more free. But you are more free on a motorbike, just especially on the Senna Road, because you can get around those caravans and those, you know, those buses and those, you know, huge tour buses which are now on there often. And it's something that troubles me, you know, the landscape becomes, or this landscape in Penwith, can somehow, with those tour buses in them, it can feel like it's vanished into a representation of itself, and it loses its meaning in a way that I find really...
Because the tourist industry is so...
It becomes
obvious.
A leisure pursuit, or it becomes just a vista, it becomes a sort of undifferentiated, it becomes nice, and it loses its problematic qualities, and it loses its potency in some way. But there's this feeling that... It just feels bland, because it's the opposite of bland to me. It's really charged, and it has all these different narratives that attach to it, and all of these.
And it's curious thinking about Michelle's pieces, because these are actually made in sort of 1979, 80, 81, and of course, you know, she's found particular kind of viewpoints, particular landscapes that do look. I mean, they're very agricultural landscapes, but they're sort of unspoiled. You know, but of course, if you go around Avebury or Stonehenge or something now, again, those are, you know, you can't ignore the kind of touristic infrastructure that has sprung up in those landscapes.
Mm.
You're making work about landscape, but you're kind of acknowledging that you can't, it is impossible. You can't really put yourself in the skin of someone else who's kind of passing through a particular place and somehow capture that experience. You can only kind of give a key that sort of unlocks this kind of accumulated what you've called cultural debris. This sense of all things kind of stacking up over time, that somehow you make a collage of those things, rather, and that's the best you can do in terms of representation.
I mean, these are all photographic works. Actually, everything here is photographic, and there's always that sort of sad thing about a photograph that it's gone. It's, that moment's gone, and you're just left thinking about the kind of husk of that moment. Which is why I always get really frustrated with people who drive to Carlos and then they don't get out of their car. Which I was talking about the other day, and they just sit there at the top of the clifftop and they don't even wind the window. They just think, why have you come?
Yeah.
Do you want to kind of find out what, don't you want to hear the sea or smell the gorse or feel the breeze? Or what is it, just your windscreen? Is that enough? I notice I return to things as artists always do, people always do, return to the same things a lot. And I'm very, I like rivers, I like that doubling that you get in a still flat surface of a river like the Halford. I like that glassy sort of the movement of a boat across a flat water, which is so frictionless and flat. And then you're suspended between one field and another on this plane. It's a very nice place to be. So I was attracted to the backwater image because I know it, I feel it, it's like a sensation. So
I think this project kind of captures that quite nicely. This sort of the film is quite extraordinary, but you never see the thing that everybody's there to see. You only get these kind of really bizarre conversations that people are having about, you know, an argument over an apple tree with a neighbour, or you know, it's everything but the thing that is the subject of the film, and that's what you're talking about.
What are all those people looking at, sitting on the beach in deck chairs? They are looking at the sea. But the sea is only the sea. We all know what the sea is like. We do not have to travel 200 miles, as some of these people have done, just to make sure it is still there. We know it cannot get away. So what are they all doing there, staring at the sea? That is what they are doing. They are staring at the sea. They are not talking much. They are not calculating long sums. They are not waiting for a monster to emerge. You ask them what they are doing and they say, I'm staring at the sea. What do you think I'm doing? Of course, some of them might say, we're sunbathing. But how can that be true? Why do they have to come all the way to the sea just to sunbathe? They can sunbathe in their backyards if it's only the sun they want. No, they are there on the beach to see the sea first, the sun second, and perhaps the other people third. If you doubt this, then wait till it begins to rain and the wind comes up raking the beaches and the promenades with spray. Then the people drive up to the sea as close as they can, get in their cars and park there, with their windows shut tight and their transistor radios going. They sit eating sandwiches and staring at the sea through the windscreen. What is it they see in the sea? It is a question, not easy to answer.
James and he's an archaeologist. And my name's Abigail Reynolds and I'm an artist. And this trip is partly, well, the reason we're doing it now is because there's an exhibition at Kessel Barton Gallery on the lizard. And in that show I have a sculpture which is called Toll. all images of Men and Tom.
The monument, as was cleared in the 1990s, would therefore comprise one hold stone, three uprights, there, four recumbent stones, that being one of them, two recumbent stones hidden by turf, but probed. Of course, impossible to know without excavation whether they're real or not. Possible stump of broken upright, I'm not sure which one that is. And a possible cairn on the edge of the monument, which is possibly part of this lumpy bit of ground just to the south of the whole stone, and that's not uncommon.
That's good. I just have one note word to say, which is that children eating crisps and sound recording do not mix at all. So children eating crisps, either go far away over there and eat them, or just don't crinkle them at all.
We're here at the Men and Toll, and the site's an enigma, as you probably all know. I mean, maybe most of you have been here before, maybe all of you have been here. Because it's so enigmatic, I've made a few notes, because I can't remember everything. It's a site that I've dipped in and out of for the last 30 years, probably. Came here before I was a professional archaeologist. And its national significance has been recognised for a long time, because it was one of the first sites to be scheduled back in 1930 or thereabouts. So even then it was considered an important archaeological monument. But it's Thomas Tonkin back in 1700 who first gives us the recorded mention of the Men and Toll as Main Toll. Main meaning stone, toll meaning hole. And it's then William Borlase, the great grandfather of W.C. Borlase in the 19th century, who draws it for the first time. So he creates a survey and an engraving of the stones. And because he was such an accomplished draftsman and has left so much from other sites, I think we can assume, although it's been disputed, I think we can probably assume that Borlase's plan of the site is probably accurate. And what's interesting about Borlase's plan is that he shows the stones in a different arrangement to how they are today, a more of a triangular plan between the hold stone and the two either side thing. So I'll read a quote from Borlase. Now he repeats one of Tonkin's. Tonkin would have seen it and recorded it around about 1700. And he describes it as famous for curing pain in the back by going through the hole 3, 5, or 9 times, and to be against the sun as well. So I'm guessing because east is over there and west is over there, pretty much, then that means passing through the hole in that direction, kind of anti-clockwise to the other stones. So Borlase, when we know that he viewed the site in 1749 and wrote about it in 1769, and he says that when I was last at this monument in the year 1749, a very intelligent farmer of the neighbourhood assured me that he had known many persons who had crept through this holdstone for pains in their backs and limbs, and that fanciful parents at certain times of the year do customarily draw their young children through in order to cure them of rickets. He showed me also two brass pins carefully laid across each other on the top edge of the hold stone. This is the way of the over-curious, even at this time, and by recurring to these pins and observing their direction to be the same or different from what they left them in, or by their being left or gone, they are informed of some material incident of love or fortune. So Borlase is describing that the stones as a divination, having some divining powers, which is rather good. But as I say, he recorded them as being triangular in plan. So it appears to be around about 1825 that we might suspect that the whole stone is moved from being slightly further south to being moved into this line to the north, so that the two stones either side are directly in line with it. And Blight, the such an accomplished draftsman, working at the same time and alongside W.C. William Copeland Borlase in the late 19th century, starts to record the other stones. and starts to wonder whether in fact the stones as they are, as he sees them, are part of a much larger monument. That's disputed really from then right up until the 1990s, with some writers claiming that other stones that are seen either side are just coincidental, such as the stone there Sue is sitting on, and perhaps this one that's semi-recumbent. And even John Barnett, who's quite a respected writer on prehistoric Britain, thinks that they're in fact they're just random moor stones. But it was the work of Van Preston Jones, really, in the 1990s, who came here to do some work in conserving the stone, because it's been so regularly visited that there was a lot of wear and puddling and all of that around the stone. It was looking like the whole stone was about to fall over, which it may well have done several times over the last few hundred years. That Cornwall Archaeological Unit came out here, reappraised the antiquarian evidence, and also carried out further clearance around it to see whether there might be some validity in this idea that the stones themselves were part of a stone circle. Now, there are only two stones in Cornwall with a diameter of that sort of width, two hold stones, this one, and the Tolvan stone, which is in Gweek. And so they would be the only hold stones capable of passing anybody through, yourself or a child. All the other hold stones in Cornwall, you could probably just about get your hand through, perhaps. If it is part of a stone circle, being unique, really, there are no other stone circles recorded anywhere in Britain or Europe, I don't think, that have a hold stone as part of the circle. So if we go back to the work that was being carried out in the 90s, there was quite a lot of clearance work done. And during that time, some other outlying stones were revealed, and it was established that these were of significant length to fit within the idea of the Cornish stone circle, all of them being around about a metre in height, probably not, were never bedded much into a socket, consequently they've always all fallen over. Various people have remarked on perhaps the significance of the hold stone and how it might have been used for astronomical, might have had some sort of instrument for astronomical observations, the rising or the setting suns. But of course that assumes that the alignment as we see it today was always the original alignment. We really don't think it was. So let's stick with the idea of it as being a part of a stone circle. And we could probably take a minute at some point while we're here to have a wander around some of the ever-encroaching moor to see whether we can identify any of these stones that Anne saw back in the 90s. Personally, I'm the sort of person who always likes to see it for myself, so I like to actually do the digging and have a look and feel the stones myself.
Thank you.
were artists, Cornish artists who've come before us. Ithel Colquhoun wrote The Living Stones, Cornwall. And she says, I'm just going to read you the beginning of her chapter called Living Stones. The life of a region depends ultimately on its geologic substratum, for this sets up a chain reaction which passes, determining their character, in turn through its streams and wells, its vegetation and the animal life that feeds on this, and finally through the type of human being attracted to live there. In a profound sense also, the structure of its rocks gives rise to the psychic life of the land. Granite, serpentine, slate, sandstone, limestone, chalk and the rest have each their special personality, dependent on the age in which they were laid down, each being coexistent with a special phase of the earth spirit's manifestation. West Penwith is granite, one of the oldest rocks, a byword for hardness, endurance, inflexibility. That is the fundamental fact about Cornwall's westernmost hundred, which is here. Unless you like granite, you will not find happiness there. There you go. Is this relationship between a spiritual or psychic reading and what we find here and how stones have been used before. And recumbent, that sense of reclining, it's a very anthropomorphic word to use about an object that's fallen over in the landscape or been pushed over. We talk about them a bit like bodies. The Western Morning News, August the 12th, eclipse souvenir. High up on the Penwith Hills, standing in the mystical Menantol ancient monument, Druids, including King Arthur Pendragon, had come there for a ceremony to help protect the stones. And together, Arthur with his sun crown and his green robe, together with Druid priests and priestesses, chanted and hit gongs to try and clear the clouds. it didn't work. Coming to it today, yeah, there's no agreement of what this represents now or then. I find this really intriguing, this sort of sense of the alignments of the sun and moon and how we as human beings exist here in our tiny forms on this spinning ball and what our place in all of this is. And a sense of spirituality. I don't want to shut that down, but neither do I wholly subscribe to it. I feel interested but doubting.
As you look around you on the West Penwith Peninsula, you're looking at a ceremonial landscape or a ritualised landscape that spans several thousand years. So we might think of a visitor coming here might see the Menantol stones, they might see Men Scrifa, and they might see Lanyon Coit and assume they're all part of the same megalithic building tradition, whereas in fact they're not. They span, you know, Men Scrifa perhaps 7th century AD, Menantol perhaps 2000 BC, Lanyon Coit perhaps 3000 BC. But of course there's plenty that belongs to this this kind of chronology as well. So in the what we call the lowland areas, the valleys of the Lizard and the Foy and the Fowl and so on, you're talking about an area that's been where it's all agricultural intake for the last 1,000 years and before. And so these ritual monuments, if you want to call them that, many have been incorporated into houses or field walls or gateposts and don't survive anymore as part of the ritual landscape as we see it here.
Are there any sites around here where you've got records of more new kind of myths springing up?
Well, it's interesting that a lot of the hold stones and some of the other stone circles often have either fertility rituals or sort of betrothal rituals and things associated with them. Possibly some of them in quite recent memory. And the thing about this one is quite interesting, that if you look at the historic documentary accounts of the Menantol, there appears to be no reference to fertility rituals or betrothal rituals or anything. But if you look at the recent writings, mainly in the later 20th century, those writers start to associate the Menantol with fertility.
We believe, I think, that the societies that would have built these kind of monuments were matriarchal. So, do we believe that? I think some of us do.
I think maybe those ideas are a little bit old hat now. Yeah. But in fact, we're much more likely to say today that we haven't got a clue.
The past, rather like the future, you can project your fantasies onto. So the fantasy of a society that was not aggressive, that was matriarchal instead of the patriarchal society we live in now, you can project quite safely onto, because how are we even going to, there's no written records. We only have these rather, these very enigmatic monuments to think about. And
it's about time and distance, yeah. And therefore it's enigmatic and it's otherworldly. And
I suppose it's that thing, like, and you said visitor experience then, which is always a sort of phrase that makes me feel a bit sick.
Time yesterday reading through TripAdvisor comments on the Menantol, which are fascinating in themselves. Generally, people were wowed and thought it was incredible. Many people were very disappointed because there's an expectation here as a result of a lot of this literature.
Yeah,
there's an expectation that people are going to come out and hear and see something the size of Stonehenge.
Yes, with the sun coming
through. Yeah, with the sun coming through. And they come out and they go, is this it or is this a model or something? And somebody says something like, worth the walk on a sunny day, but you could just do it by looking at pictures.
Which carries my home.
This is the first of two trail mixed editions drawing from the exhibition Ledger Lines at Kessel Barton, a gallery on the Lizard in Cornwall. The exhibition runs until July 9th. The second show will expand on the works of artists Sophie Rickett and Michelle Stewart, who are also participating in the show. For a track list and references, please see trailmixedweb.wordpress.com. Trail Mix is produced by the artist, pedestrian and writer Bram Thomas Arnold. For more information, see www.bramthomasarnold.com.